All right, I've got 10:50 or maybe a little after that, so let's get going. Whenever you need to reload on the licorice, it'll be right up here. And just to sort of get settled here, last year when I gave this talk and had licorice as my bribe, I started my talk and I started the licorice over on this side, and I had two of those small boxes, one red one and one black one. And in typical fashion, like last night, I talked for about 20 minutes without taking a breath, and then I said, "Are there any questions?" And sitting over here on this edge was a little 7 or 8 year old boy, Luke. Hand shoots up, and I'm like, "Oh, this is going to be cool, right? Young kid, eat it." Yeah. Could you tell me where the licorice is? And it had gotten about that. Both boxes, like 100 pieces of licorice, had got that far, and it was all gone. So he was distraught. And because I had the rest of my stash of licorice up at my room, I couldn't very well leave class to go do that. But I said, "If you come to the hike tomorrow, you'll get the first piece." And so that got me out of trouble then. And the way I solved it this time was by bringing 3 pounds of licorice. Do your best to eat me out of licorice this time. As I was sorting through my papers, or as I was sorting through my box of training aids here, I came across something. This is old school, right? This was pre-PowerPoint. And this is our thesis, and you can read that, or you can trust me to say that it's hardly changed at all since 2002, the first time I posted this up on that wall right there. So either I still believe what I said back then, or I'm too lazy to change it. Stuck in a rut. But it's a good rut. Is there anyone who wasn't here last night? There's stuff in there that's going to be on the quiz, so you want to study that. Okay. If you want to learn geology, but don't want to have to deal with anybody else, like going to school at a community college, Putnam's Geology is an excellent introductory geology text. Or if you're wandering by your local used bookstore, there's another book called Earth by Preston Sieber. This is fairly old. It may even be out of print now. You'll want a geology textbook that was written since about 1985, something like that, with an introductory geology text and either a dictionary or a thesaurus. You can get going on your own. The Roadside Geology series that I'm sure you've seen in your local independent bookseller. I think these are a good series of books that are neither too simple nor too complicated. And the way the book is set up is the Roadside Geology of Washington. This is based on the roads of Washington. So if you're going to drive Highway 97 from Chelan back to the road that goes back to Seattle, you can look in here and see what the geology is along the way, and there's pictures in there, and there's maps, and it shows you where you want to stop and what you can look and see. Another source that you have for geology field trips, I lived in Portland until about 6 months ago, and weekly in the paper there was somewhere hidden in the back of one of the sections was sort of upcoming talks of a variety of things, dumb things like plants and trees, but then stuff like geology. And I recall there's a guy at the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality who I worked with on some projects who was regularly giving talks, or through Portland State, again, your local community college or your local university. And honestly, it seems to me that in the geology fraternity, we're fairly welcoming about having newcomers and trying to do what we can to entice them into the racket. So, John McPhee, he has written a series of 4 books that are basic, that are geology based. In Suspect Terrain was the first one, and it's 20 years old now. And John McPhee was a New Yorker. writer for the New Yorker, at one time I thought I would try to write geology to try to take it and explain it to people. And after reading his books, I know that that niche has already been filled. His description of geologic events and occurrences and is just better than I'll ever do. So, and this is the compendium of all four of those books in one location. And it's really excellent. Okay, we've covered licorice. Resources. All right, now it's down to the heavy lifting. Enough of that happy-go-lucky stuff from last night. Now it's all work, nothing but work. So, some folks came in late. Were you here last night?
Yes.
Okay, so you've got a handout. All right, here's, again, as I talked about last night, the play that I used for my title of this talk is based off a sign that I saw in Copenhagen 2 or 3 years ago. We have one fundamental concept of geologic forces and how they shape what we can see. This is how geology operates. Whether you ever decide to study geology or not, this is an important thing that you can think about as you're driving along, and you can continue to, it's a framework that you can put things in. We have one thesis for how we study geology. We talked about it last night. We're going to talk about it again in a minute. We have five principles or laws to help us organize our observations, interpretation, and hypotheses. That's what we're going to focus on today. And then there are three main types of rocks. We'll talk about that tomorrow. I work a lot in analogy, and sometimes I think that the analogies I use are brilliant, and everybody looks at me like what am I? Like I'm Charlie Brown's teacher, right? Wah, 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 wah. What I have used in the past is that rocks are sort of the words of geology. What we're going to talk about today are sort of the rules of grammar. The way that you can take those individual words and try to put them into some larger framework that then helps us. Maybe that analogy will work for you, maybe it won't. We'll see. The fundamental concept you always keep in mind about geology is that everything that we see is due to the interplay between constructive geologic forces and destructive geologic forces. Now, I wrote that a year ago, and in the last year, as this idea has come back to me, when I write definitive things like this, I actually try to evaluate after a while whether they're actually true, and I think that's fairly important. And I've come up with one thing that doesn't really fit into this framework, and that would be the impact of meteorites. Those come from outside this realm that I'm talking about, which is constructive forces, the earth being built from within, and destructive forces, erosion taking place in the atmosphere, and then there's this 0.001%. So, As a consultant where I can be held legally liable for the stuff I say, almost, let's see if this pointer will work. If you put an almost right there, then I'll be done with my legal liability. Okay, so this is the thing. Even if you don't decide to look at geology ever again, if you can keep this in mind, this will make you seem really smart at cocktail parties. Okay. Here's a little bit of backup for that, and again, it's as simple as it can be. The Earth is hot in the center, and it's cold at the outside. Heat flows from hot to cold. When you put a pan on the stove and you turn the stove on, that pot's hot at the bottom, it's cold at the top. The heat tries to rise and come to the top, and it bubbles up when you boil water. Heat flow sets up convection cells and moves the solid crust around the surface of the Earth, and our current best explanation of this is called plate tectonics theory. Now, this is a lava lamp, which is not only a great household decoration, but also a reasonably good geologic aid. Hot at the center, cold at the outside. Material is heated, raises up as it moves away from the heat source. It begins to cool, gets to the surface, and cools. Analogy time. If we wanted to know what was inside a baseball, We can take it over to the shop there and cut it open and look. And this is a representation of that so that we could see what we don't know by looking at the outside. All we think it is four-sided stitches. Inside there is a cork center and then a bunch of yarn wrappings that make up the inside of the baseball, and it's stitched on the outside. If we conceptually do the same thing with the planet that we live on, called the Earth, this is what we think it is. We haven't ever actually cut it in half and opened it up to look at it. But based on, mostly on the way earthquake waves travel, we've decided or come up that this is the best representation we have for the construction of the Earth. So that at the center, the core is solid and made of iron. It's incredibly hot, but it's also got enough stuff sitting on top of it so that even though it's really hot, because there's so much weight on top of it, the molecules can't move around much, which is what defines a solid. There is a mantle, a solid but flowy material, and then a crust on the outside, which is the stuff we're standing on now. Solid but flowy material. Is glass a solid or a liquid?
Solid.
Solid, liquid, black licorice, red licorice. It's an extremely dense fluid. So that what has been reported to me is if you go to the churches in England that were built in 1200, the windows are thicker at the bottom than they are at the top because they've been flowing under gravity for the last 800 years now. So think of and if we allow that material to move very slowly, it will flow. If we try to make it move quickly, it will break. So that's the concept that I think of as the mantle, not necessarily glass, but that really, really dense material that will flow given enough time. If you can take that idea and sort of make circular cells out of it now, I think that's a better representation of what really is happening in the mantle where that material is moving hot down here. Another thing that heating stuff up does is makes it less dense, right? It makes the molecules move apart, more space in between them, less dense, moves upward through more dense material, cools as it's rising. And these convection cells develop, and this is what generates and motivates the plates around on the surface of the planet. What we have right now are somewhere between 13 and 20 plates, depending on how big or small your plate needs to be. These are sort of, one text has described them as sort of eggshells floating on top of something that moves around. They crash into each other, we call those earthquakes. The plate that India sits on crashed into Eurasia. That crash is what's caused the Himalayan mountains. Again, this is all very quick, very simple. There's going to be a whole chapter about that in any book that you read. Part of what helped us understand and develop the theory of plate tectonics was the distribution of earthquakes. What do? We observe. We figured out where all the earthquakes were. What's the next thing we do? We interpret. We say, why do we see this pattern? If it were completely random, we would expect to see these dots reasonably equally distributed everywhere on the planet. That's not what we see. Why is it the way that it is? And what we find out is that this is where the plate boundaries are. These, I think a couple of these slides are in your set of handouts. And another bit of information that back in the early 1900s led some people to believe, start to develop the idea of plate tectonics was if you take some of the continents, they seem to fit together very nicely. When I first started studying geology in 1976, we thought that the Earth was the crust of the mantle and the creamy nougat center. That's an old theory that we've gotten rid of. Come on, that's a little bit funny. I guess it's funnier to geologists. All right. Constructive geologic forces, the thing that builds mountains, the things that raises these mountains up, that's what we've covered so far. That's due to the dissipation of heat. The Earth is hot in the middle because both of the latent heat from the formation of the Earth, which formed from asteroid comet impacts, those generate heat, and the natural radioactivity of the material. We're dissipating heat. In some couple of billion years, the heat will all run out. Mountain building will stop. The world will be eroded down to something fairly low and flat.
Don?
Yes, sir.
What's if plate tectonics are a major cause of earthquake, what happens, what causes an earthquake where there's no intersection of plates?
Either if you push on, let me think about this for a minute, if you push on a block of hard material, there may be stresses and strains that build up in the material. Some of those are released at sort of the edge of the material, but some of that is still held within the center of the block and then releases slowly later on, or less violently later on. And the other part is maybe there's a fault there that we haven't identified yet. That happens all the time. Okay, rocks are raised in the environment. The environment wears down the rocks due to surficial processes related to wind, water, and ice. I would add gravity in there. Big mountains up here, Copper and Dumbbell, sometimes rocks just shed off the mountains, right? There's no water or ice, therefore that's a minor impact. Once you raise something up into the environment, gravity wants to bring it back down. The higher the rocks, the mountains are raised, the more effect the environment can have. You raise up mountains high enough, and pretty soon you have waterfalls, and the steeper the waterfall, the more energy there is, and the more ability that water has to break rocks apart and move them down valley. Here's Railroad Creek, somewhat lower gradient than the waterfall, which is 10 mile falls, which we'll see in a couple of days. One of the other big geologic destructive forces is glaciers. This is one of the few photos that isn't mine. So, basic concept of geology. Some forces are trying to make the planet really tall. Other forces are trying to make the planet really small or really low. And it's the way they interplay that causes 99.99% of everything we see. Here's our same thesis from yesterday. Observational science. Observation, interpretation, and hypothesis, right? Those are the key words to take out of this. And what I would argue, because it's true, is this is a continuing cycle. We make a bunch of observations, we make some interpretations as we're sitting around at the end of the day having our beer, helping us have better imaginations. We say, well, if here's what we see, that must mean this. Well, whatever this is, that leads us to this next idea. Well, that's a hypothesis we can test. How are we going to test it? Well, we run some test, and then based on the results of the test, we either say, man, we're smart, or we say, well, our interpretation is wrong, so now what are we going to do? How are we going to change our mind? So that cycle continues on. Again, how do you observe things? You observe a lot just by watching. If we look very briefly, this is a boring log. Not a boring log, a log of a geologic boring. DS9D at the Holden mine site in 2009, logged by D. Coberly and B. Gray, Brian Gray, a very good geologist. The point I want to make here is what material description, right? It doesn't say material identification, it doesn't say material hypothesis, it doesn't. Poorly graded gravel. Gravel, fine, sub-rounded to sub-angular. Fine is a size. You can tell a size, right? I can tell you the particulars of it, but you can tell the difference between big and small. That you don't need any great talent to do that. Maybe you need some talent. Maybe you need to talk to an artist. Sub-rounded to sub-angular. Is it round or is it angular? There are pieces right here that are either subrounded or subangular. We'll talk more about that tomorrow, but that's an observation. Loose to medium dense, when we found a bag of it, was it something that you could push your thumb into or was it really hard? Dry to moist. You can tell the difference between dry and moist, right? That's not that. There's stuff that Cliff knows as a doctor that's pretty darn complicated that we probably wouldn't grasp straight away. In geology, you can tell the difference between dry and moist, right? Because you've got common sense, because you're not the guy that put the post in the middle of the driveway or put a secret nuclear bunker on the sign, right? You're not that guy. You've got common sense. So the point here is, this is important stuff in the big geology world, and it's 85% observation. And then down at the bottom, there's an interpretation. That's alluvium. That's a kind of geologic material. This is a slide from a course that I helped, I was on the fringes of teaching in Perth, Australia, 10 days ago to a bunch of graduate hydrogeologists on how to do geologic logging for the big mining clients that we're working for in Australia. Skip the first line for a minute, put that in brackets, as the pastors would say. Let's not talk about that right now. What are the things that we log? We log the color. You guys can tell color. Grain size. Again, there are various size scales that we use, but you can tell the difference between big and small. Sorting is, are the particles like each other or are they different from one another? Again, simple observation. Roundness. Density, cohesion, and plasticity. This works for smaller grain material like clay. How plastic is it? How much is it like modeling clay? So again, here's stuff that we're spending a lot of money and guys who are fairly experienced talking about to people who are trying to learn things, and it's exactly the same stuff I'm telling you guys. I should be charging a lot for this. All right, we have five guiding principles or laws. Here are sort of the rules of grammar. The first one of these is called the principle of least astonishment. This should be in your set of handouts. The principle of least astonishment expressed philosophically is Occam's razor. The bit in orange here is the important part. The simplest explanation is usually the correct one. When we're making hypotheses, and you have a hypothesis that's one line long, and I have a hypothesis that's 12 lines long, yours is probably going to be correct. Or, as to take this into geologic parlance, which I heard from guys that worked at the University of Arizona, is they call it the principle of least astonishment. When we're talking about something and we're developing a hypothesis, let's not have to invoke, if your two grandsons are standing in the living room and the lamp has been knocked off the table and is laying on the ground and you say, "What happened?" And they say, "It was crazy. A rhinoceros came through the living room." And you say, "Oh, and so did the rhinoceros knock the lamp off?" And you, "No, it was the tiger who was chasing." And you go, "Oh, okay." Or you say, "Nah, I'm not sure I'm buying it." Now, it is possible. Here's my hypothesis. My hypothesis is there was this triangle of six rolls of toilet paper, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, on that bed, and the cat tried to crawl underneath without tipping any of the rolls of toilet paper, and it was so strenuous for the cat that as soon as that happened, the cat fell asleep. Anybody with me on that? Is my hypothesis a little more astonishing than what likely happened, right? That the cat fell asleep and then whatever college student this was or a young professional that had too much time on their hands decided let's stack stuff on top of the cat. Okay, I try to, as I'm thinking about these things, I try to make the first example as absurd as possible to try to anchor that to say, remember when there was the sleeping cat with the toilet paper on top of it? Now, okay, I've got it. I'm standing up on top of a hill here, on top of rocks like this. There was a road down below, and on the road is a boulder. One hypothesis we might entertain, or actually there's two more down there. One hypothesis we might entertain is that the boulder rolled down there, and then they decided to build a road, but they did a very good job of building the flat road all the way around Boulder. Anybody else find that? Okay, of course not. That's not what happened. It's more likely that they built the road and then after that the rock rolled onto it. The principle of least astonishment doesn't just work on Earth, it also works on Mars, which is where this satellite image is from. Here's a big fan that's been blobbed out from some mountains at some time in the past when there was water on Mars. One of the hypotheses we might entertain is that happened, except for right here, it just coincidentally moved around something in a perfect circle. Could happen, right? Well, maybe. Or else at some point after this big thing happened, there was a meteorite impact there, and since those form really round shapes, all right, it's the second of those hypotheses that's more likely. So let's go with that. It's less astonishing. The principle of we're a fifth of the way through basic geology. All right, we've got one of the five rules, and sort of the rule that rules them all. Always try to keep things simple. We may not always be right, but we'll be right almost all of the time. Okay, the principle of uniformitarianism. Now, all this stuff is in your book, so you can write additional notes on there. The present is the key to the past. Imagine for a second you're working in the office and you come across this notebook and you see it and you say, I wonder who wrote those notes. We're going back to June 20th, 1997. It was a Friday. You remember that. And I'd sure like to know who wrote these notes. How are we going to figure that out? Well, if you could go around from room to room in the office and say, did you write this? Did you write this? People would say no. Perhaps that person has moved on, is no longer in the office. And then, someplace else, you come across a set of notes, and they're from May 24th, 2010, and you look down at the bottom, and you say, ah, D.M. Coberly, that's who wrote those notes. And you compare the printing, and you say, this is May 24th, 2010. And this is June 20th, 1997. Do they look the same?
Yeah.
Probably the same dude. As it turns out, that's the case. In that first slide I showed you, I had whited out my name so you couldn't tell it. But because you can tell my... And one of the secret powers I have is I can tell printing. I know who's printed things. So I wanted to be able to fly, but this is what I got instead. So the present is... And last year... 2010, May was the present. It's getting a little bit older. But take something that we know what it is, we see a set of observations, a set of characteristics of that thing, let's transfer that into the past. Here's a rock from somewhere in the world, I'm not sure where it is, this is again another photo that, maybe this is mine, it's a long time ago, I forget. But we can go into that textbook right there, and see a picture of contoured ropey lava on Footprint Trail, Kilauea Volcano, Hawaii, from the U.S. Geological Survey, and you look at those curved surfaces, and they look exactly like the curved surfaces on that prior slide. You say, we know this is ropey lava because we watched it come out and solidify. Let's make the assumption, the principle of least astonishment, that what we see in the geologic record is formed by the same process that we've seen with our very own eyes. Oops. If you go up by the ball field, take the road out to the ball field, just before you get to the ball field, if you look across to the far side of Railroad Creek, there's a big cut bank there. This stuff is junk that's fallen down from above, but there are also these very thin and regular layers. Can you see that in the slide that you have? This is an important thing. What I'm telling you, because it's true, or you could take my word because I'm a geologist, is that those are lake sediments. That at some point in the past, there was a lake where the ball field is right now. And every spring, with the spring melt, there was material that was brought down through the creek. The creek goes into the lake, energy drops off, drops out the particles, and you get this very regular set of layers. That happens in water. It happens either in a lake or it happens in the ocean. Up on my list of pending questions right there is, how do we get a lake at the ball field? That would be one thing, as you would look at these and you would make your observation and you say, these are flat-lying layers, they're thin, they're brown material. If you go, if you hike across, walk across the creek and get over there, it's fairly soft material, blah, blah, blah. One of the first questions that might come to you is, well, there's not a lake here now. How did we get a lake here? Let's hold on to that for right now. But as you begin to think geologically, when you see material that you say, well, that's lake material, how do we get a lake here? When you see that same layering in some other location, again, principle of least astonishment, principle of uniformitarianism, that was probably created by a lake. Lakes now don't work like glaciers used to work. Okay? Glaciers now work like glaciers used to work. Lakes now work like lakes used to work. This is in Rifle, Colorado. We're a mile above sea level, maybe a little bit more. So one of the questions you have to ask yourself, if this is a lake, it's a big darn lake, or two, if it was in the ocean, at some point this material was below the ocean. Right? That's all common sense. Here's material that this is a photograph. We've seen something like this from yesterday. This is off the flank of Mount St. Helens. This is post May 18th, 1980. What happened on May 18th, 1980?
It blew.
Mount St. Helens blew, and Magic Johnson played center for the Lakers in the last game of the finals against Philadelphia that the Lakers won.
Okay.
That's another thing that happened that day. Which has nothing to do with geology, but anyway. So, we see material like this on the side of Mount St. Helens. You know, this is recent material, post-May 18th. All right. Well, next time I see material that looks sort of like this, I have that picture in my head, and I go, where have I seen that before? Right? Where have I seen that curved black lava before? Where have I seen those banded layers before, and what did I read about them? I'm going to keep browbeating you with this. We can observe a lot just by watching. What do we notice about this material? This is sort of priming the pump for tomorrow when we'll talk about it more. Round or not round?
Both.
No.
Generally not round. How many pieces of that? Here's a fairly rounded piece, but of the 50 pieces in there we can see, most of them are fairly angular, right? They have sharp edges on them. That edge right there, and of course, particularly being a consultant, we like to hedge our bets a lot. So in between rounded and angular, or sub-rounded and sub-angular, so there's this scale. So I'm willing to buy sort of sub-angular, right? It's not broken glass sharp, but there aren't a whole lot of pieces on there. I had a geology professor who said the difference between sub-rounded and sub-angular is you can still sit on sub-rounded, but you don't want to sit on sub-angular. Right? If you had to sit on this piece for the entirety of this lecture, you'd think it was dang angular, wouldn't you? What I see is a wide variety of sizes. Stuff here that's probably smaller than my fingernail. One of the things that's not so good about this slide that you can yell at the geologist about is there's no scale in here, right? If this is a super blown up thing and this is thing only an inch across, well that's not what happened. That rock is maybe this big round, right? So there's a huge variety of sizes involved here. Mostly subangular, a little bit of sub-rounded material, and that is a dramatically different piece of rock than most anything else in there, right? If we go to the easiest thing and we look at colors, and you guys have got a better view, there's some sort of pinkish stuff, maybe that gray stuff, those two to me look fairly similar to the material. So if we were looking at this, if we were writing down our notes, we'd say predominantly gray subangular, some reddish material, gray subrounded. That's pumice of something. We can see the texture of that is something different. Wide variety of grain sizes, blah, blah, blah. And store it. We'd write that down. We'd put a point on our map. And then we'd go at the end of the day and talk to the other geologists and drink our beer and say, what do you think this means? The first thing we do is we make our observations. Here's some more material from Mount St. Helens. Again, in this case, there's very little rock and very much more what geologists call matrix, the fine-grained stuff in between the fragments. Any questions to this point while I take a quick drink of Gatorade? Any questions? Okay? You can read through this, and is this entirely in your handouts or just the bottom part?
Entirely.
Just the bottom.
I've got a page where the whole thing is in here.
Okay. Most rocks that we see are sedimentary. We'll talk about that more tomorrow. Sedimentary rocks are formed of small pieces of rock called sediment, falling under the force of gravity, lay down either in lakes or in the ocean. Gravity works downward, it always has. If it hadn't, that would be astonishing. So the conclusion of that set of things is that sedimentary rocks are laid down flat or nearly so. All of that is not very revealing to us. It's the next couple of points. Tilted rocks were not laid down flat. No, tilted rocks were not laid down tilted. That would be astonishing. So when we find rocks that are not flat, unflat as I say, we need to explain why. So, here is that very characteristic layering. I'm telling you right now that that's from a sedimentary rock. These rocks are clearly, I didn't stage this by putting the camera up on end. This is a natural photo taken. These rocks are tilted up. We need to come up with some explanation as to why they're that way. As we're writing down our observations, we say fine-grained sedimentary rock, banded, some thicker bands, some thinner bands, tilted at an angle. Now, when we go back at the end of the day, we have to figure out they weren't laid down tilted, right? We could hypothesize that as this rock was being formed, that each of the gray particles fell and piled up right here and built this thing up, while all the black particles did the same thing. It's possible, it's just really unlikely, right? It's more likely that everything was laid down flat and it was tipped up. Law of original horizontality, even complicated there. Rocks tip both ways. This is a photo we saw again last night from Australia. Again, this material was probably laid down below the either lake or ocean level. In this case, I believe it was the ocean. It's not flat anymore. How did it get that way? The law of superposition. All right, that's two down, right? Principle of least astonishment, and no, it's three down. We're killing it. All right, the law of superposition. The oldest stuff is on the bottom. This is a geology rule, but it also applies to cake assembling, newspaper recycling, and laundry. How does it do that, you might ask? Well, if you're building a cake, you put the bottom layer down, and then you put some frosting on it, and then you put another layer down, you put the frosting on it, put another layer of frosting, right? That's the way I would do it. If you wanted to, you could, like, put four toothpicks, and then the second layer down first, and then frost it, and then slide the first layer underneath it, and then inject the frosting. That's, now we're getting into astonishing world, right? So that when we see a cake, when you cut into it, well, they don't have many layer cakes here, but if, or a torte is even worse. I mean, I usually build my torts three layers and then a space and then three layers, and then I put them in later. Cakes get built from the bottom up. If you know someone who is really set in their ways, who gets up every morning and has two cups of coffee and a bowl of oatmeal with a little bit of sugar on top and maybe a little cream, and reads the paper, and as soon as they're done reading the paper, they take it out and they put it in the recycling bin. Just as an example, just as a, let's say Otto. Let's call this guy Otto.
Happens.
Thank you very much. At the end of 2 weeks, when it was time for the recycling to go out, if we would go and look in Otto's, our made-up Otto, if we would go look in his recycling bin, the top paper would be from the 23rd. and below that would be the paper from the 22nd, and below that the 21st, and below that, right?
Yes.
That's right. And if it's somebody like Otto, it's exactly going to be that way. The oldest stuff, the paper from, you say, where's the bottom, where's the paper for the 14th? I don't have to cycle through the top going there, it's going to be in here somewhere. I just go all the way to the bottom and pull that out, and it's the 14th, and I hand it to you, right? That's how it works in newspaper recycling. How does it work in laundry, you may ask? I know you're dying to find out. I will tell you how it works in laundry. This is a picture of the closet of the bedroom that I used to live in Portland, and there's my laundry basket. This was after Labor Day weekend one year, and if you look in on top of my laundry basket, you see something gray on top and then some red. And if you go in and pull out the entire stack of laundry, what you see, what we saw, what my housemate saw, what I first saw that I ran out and told my housemate I needed a picture of was this. The bottom thing is a red golf shirt, and on top of that is a green golf shirt, and on top with some socks sticking out, and on top of that are some brown pants, and then another red golf shirt, and then a blue golf shirt, and some more, and then a gray set of pants on top. Principle of least astonishment. Law of superposition. What's the first shirt I wore?
The red
from bottom.
The bottom, exactly so. What's the next shirt I wore? The green one. My guess would be, knowing me and knowing the stratigraphy here, is I probably wore that pair of tan pants with both of those shirts. I don't change my pants every day, I'm sorry. Does this make sense to everyone? Next question. Do we know how old that shirt is? This was the shirt I wore on Monday, and this is the shirt I wore on Tuesday, and these are the pants I wore on Monday and Tuesday, and this is the shirt I wore on Thursday.
What happened on Wednesday?
Or, this is the shirt I wore for March. This is the shirt I wore for April. These are the pants I wore for all of March and April. Or, this was my 2009 shirt. This was my 2000. The point here is this gives us relative age, younger or older. It doesn't say anything about the specific age. The difference between the laundry example and the recycling example is because each of the pages has a date on it, we know what it is. In this case, we can't tell that, right? We have hopes that this was the Monday shirt and this was the Tuesday shirt, but we can't tell that from what's going on here. Okay. These flat layers, what I believe is this layer is older, was put down before this layer was, or this layer. How old is this layer? No idea. It's older than that, but is it a billion years, or is it 500 million years, or is it 10,000 years? Can't tell you. I can tell you what's older and what's younger. I can't give you any specific dates. Same thing here. Older, younger, no idea of specific ages. A question that we have to ask ourselves that complicates this law of superposition is, are we seeing things right? We should always ask ourselves that. Are we being confused by something? Is something hidden? We need to ask ourselves which way is up. Here's the question. Have the beds rotated up from the right 45 degrees? Have they come up like that counterclockwise? Or have they come up from the left clockwise? So the other alternative is they were laying flat like this, came all the way up through vertical, all the way to where they are now, right? Those are two hypotheses. First guess we would make is 45 from the right, overturning, there's a lot more involved there. From here, how far, you'd say this overturning idea, that's crazy, or it's very unlikely, that can't happen very often. The closest overturned beds to right here are right up there at the Holden Mine. Holden Mine, the rocks that we see in the Holden Mine are precisely like this. They're much more steeply dipping, but they were laid flat this way and have come up through 90 degrees and are overturned. So this is not an uncommon event in geology, so now we need more tricks and more ideas as to how we can figure that out. How are we going to do that? In the laundry example, maybe I tried to trick you guys, and when I picked up the whole stack of stuff out of the laundry, I said, ha, and switched it over. Well, either I've double tried to trick you, or else we have some identification that shows the gray thing was on top, so that then when we see that package and the gray thing is still on top, we have some confidence. Now, how do we translate that to the geologic world? When we see curved surfaces in the geologic world, they usually bow downward rather than upward. Because what happens when we try to push something up? What happens when geology tries to push something up? The constructive forces of geology, erosion tries to flatten it back down, right? The second point here says graded bedding goes from large to small particles when the bed is right side up. I've got a picture of that, and I'll describe it again in just a minute. This, again, is at Mount St. Helen. Here are some curved surfaces in those layered materials. Can everybody see that? There's a better highlighting of those curved surfaces. Those curved surfaces bow downwards. So our interpretation will be that this package is right side up rather than the whole mess being overturned. Same thing here. Here's a big curved surface. We're going to make the assumption that because that curved surface bows down, that this package is still right side up. It hasn't been overturned somehow. If a thing that we do in geology all the time is when we see things like this, the first thing we do is turn them over and see if they make any more sense that way. And in this case, it makes much less sense unless this material were cement or something. In fact, what's happened is this is a reef. And this was a big cut in the reef that then, as that was raised up, got filled in with sediment from stream. Here is the concept of graded bedding. Means when you have big stuff at the bottom and then it gets finer as you go up, we call that fining upwards. It gets fining as we move upward. That's probably in the right orientation. So if you're out doing geology and you see this in the field, you have some confidence that that whole package that you're looking at, those layers of rocks, are in the right orientation. And I think in your handout, if you're keeping up, that there's another page in your handout that has a number of other sort of tips and tricks that you can use from the American Geophysical Institute for helping determine that. That's kind of a finer point, but that helps push you forward in doing your geology. It's either in there or else this slide is wrong, one of the two. All right, the law of crust, we're almost there, and we've got a good bit of time, don't we?
We can get into part two.
Two. No, we got time for the quiz. You guys will have more time for that. The law of cross-cutting relationship. An igneous rock, fault, or other geologic feature, let's go with other geologic feature for right now to be as broad as we can, must be younger than any rock across which it cuts. Now, again, let's use an example from outside the geology world first. This is the slide from last night. Which came first, the road or the phone line?
Road.
Or the power line, sorry. Which came first?
Road.
The road came first. Here's my hypothesis. This is not actually a tractor road. This is two motorcycle roads that you have to ride, that as they were making them, they were always riding very carefully, and so they turned out to be precisely parallel. Is anybody with me on that?
Hardly.
Okay, all right, here's another, all right, Mr. Smarty Pants, here's my idea, that when they drove to right here, they stopped. And they took the two tires off of this side, and they tipped the vehicle up and drove it on two wheels, and then they moved it back and put the wheel up and did.
No.
All right?
It's two columns of horses.
See? See? Nah, yeah. Here's someone who's going to do good on the quiz. All right. Have I belabored the principle of least astonishment? Because I can do it more if you need me to. So clearly, the road was there, and then the road was cut by a more recent event. Whoever it was that decided to put the power poles up. So, older event, younger event. Can we hypothesize on more information about the actual ages of these things? Well, these power lines weren't put up in 1700. Everybody with me on that? Do we have any argument there? Someone may have been very forward thinking and said, you know, in 150 years we're going to have need for power poles. And then Martha said to Lou, what's power? Anyway, so there is some, if we go into puzzle solving mode, if we're not into this simply for the beauty of bucolic central wherever this is, and we're trying to figure out when these things happened, this is an automobile road of some kind, so we can date it to 1906 plus, right? We can't discount the horse and carriage, right? So this road may be a 1700 road, but again, that's that. When you begin to think geologically and then take your geologic ideas into the larger world, you can say, all right, there is some. This road is clearly pre 1980 or whenever the power poles went up, because it wasn't formed after that, because otherwise we'd have had to invoke something astonishing, right? So that, again, the law of cross-cutting relationships says this is the older feature, this is the younger feature. We don't know what the ages are. We know the age relation to one another, just not in real time. Here's a set of number of different tracks on a sand dune. If we wanted to, we could try to disentangle which of these things happened first. Clearly, the deer came through after the tractor came through, right? We can see that because here's a big deer print. If the tractor had come through last, it would have covered this up. Here's a geologic situation. Here's one layer in particular that seems to stand out and then simply ends. That's because it's cut by a fault. Here's a geologic feature up in the road cut just out of Chelan. And again, here is some offset. I think there's a fault in there. So in this case, this thing is older, that thing is younger. One of the questions that some of you may be wondering about that you're too polite to ask right now is, why do we care about this? And in the puzzle-solving sense, if we go out and we collect a bunch of data and we see a bunch of these things through our area, and then we see a bunch of these that cut them, and we take our compass and we lay them on this, and these turn out to be relatively consistent in their orientation, then that helps us figure out what is the pressure. When you press on something, it has a tendency to fold or break in a certain way, right? By looking at the break, you can try to figure out how it was pressed. If I press on this book this way, that fold only happens one way, right? It happens pointing directly at Otto right now. If we take the peak of this fold, it points right at him. It doesn't point at Gay, because I push this way, because I see the fold and the orientation of the fold running between me and him. The only way that happens is if the geologic forces, or in this case, the Don forces, push in a certain direction. Knowing this, we hypothesize back to that. So with a bunch of data on these, a bunch of observations, then when we get back into the hypothesis and interpretation mode, we have some data that says, all right, we've seen this enough times. If you're working on a road cut, here one of the ways that it does matter is if you're with Oregon or WSDOT, the Department of Transportation, and you see things like this, and when a rock breaks off, if what it's going to do is fall back into the slope, you're okay with that, right? If this actually happens to have an orientation like this, coming out and onto the road, you would say that's a bad thing, right? We either need to bolt it in or blow it down or something like that. So this has practical application that would be beyond probably what we would be interested in, but there is a reason for it. We now use our geologic principles combined with our observation skills and common sense to do geology. So we have these sort of five guiding ideas that we sort of keep rolling around in our head. We go out and we collect info. We go out and we walk and we see stuff and we go, why is it the way it is? And these things that we've just talked about help us sort of framework that a little bit. And so here again in that road cut, this is an I-70 road cut between, it's past Vail and Beaver Creek, but before you get to where Rifle is, what's the town in the Glenwood Springs. Here we see a whole bunch of layers that are tipped up on end. Do you have this? Is this picture in your handout? And then some stuff on top of it. Okay, we have flat lying layers. Were they laid down like this?
Yes. No. Flat.
They were laid down flat. They were laid down flat either in a lake or laid down flat in an ocean, because that's where those things happen. So somewhere in the past, at I-70, there used to be either a lake or an ocean. We know that. Or we interpret that based on what we see. We had to get rid of the ocean or the lake, right? Because there is one there now because we're driving. We had to get the rocks and we had to tip them up on their side. Do we know whether they came up this way or came up that way? We don't know that right now. I don't know that because I haven't been over there to look at that road cut. What would we do? We'd run across all 4, 6, 8 lanes of traffic on I-70, and we'd go start looking at the rocks, and we would look for the curved surfaces, or we would look for the graded bedding, or we would look for the other tricks and tips that you have on your AGI sheet. And if we saw those curved surfaces this way, we'd say, okay, it came up 45 degrees this way. If those curved surfaces were arced like that, we would say, holy cow, not only is this stuff a mile above sea level, it's been tipped over 135 degrees. What else can we tell? Principle of least astonishment. Read through the list, somebody write quick. Present is key to the past. It's lake sediments or it's ocean sediments. Law of original horizontality. It's not horizontal anymore. We have to come up for a reason to that. Law of superposition. These beds certainly appear to be cut off by whatever this thing is up here, right? Older stuff, younger stuff. I believe that. And law of cross-cutting, that's law of cross-cutting relationships. This stuff, I'm thinking, is a mud flow or some sort of debris flow that's come down relatively recently. Can we tell anything about the precise ages of any of the material? Probably not. Any questions? That's all I have for today.
I have a question.
Yes. Dang it, I tried to get it.
How is geology taught in schools now? Considering that let's say it's a science requirement and a student chooses to have geology, but ultimately, through college, they aren't going to be a geologist, but they need to fulfill a requirement. How would they teach geology using these concepts, or
what would happen would be you would go to Putnam's Geology or a basic geology text and go through what we're going to cover tomorrow in half an hour on rocks is 3 weeks of the course. To where we're going to talk very briefly about them. You're going to learn lots of rock names in geology. These ideas are probably going to be covered fairly briefly early on and sort of set aside on your cheat sheet that says, as we move forward into this, always keep these things in mind. This is much more for casual geology and to try to get folks dialed into as much stuff as can be done quickly. My belief after having been in geology for a while, is geology one teaches you everything you need to know imperfectly, close to what's really the case. And then from then on, the rest of your scholastic career and then your professional career is why what you learned in geology one isn't quite right or is a little bit shallow. We'll talk about sedimentary rocks tomorrow in 10 minutes. That'll be 3 weeks worth of course, nine in-class hours probably, or six, something like that, because my idea is to get you interested and dangerous in geology so that you can, or intrigued, or pulled in a little by bribery, so that then you would go on and read this book and go, that guy up at Holden, he was reasonably on the mark. He didn't lead us way down the path, but he was a little imprecise on something.
This sounds like a introduction to logic.
Well, and that one of the things I've said historically about this course is that geology is common sense, right?
Okay.
When you go to a new area and study geology, one of the first things I'm going to do is find some old farmer and say, "What do you know?" Right? Because he's very pragmatic about it. He's not clouded up with graduate school like I am. Here's where the water comes out of the ground. Well, okay, that's where the permeable stuff is, right? So it's. I honestly believe geology is 90% common sense, and then 10% how do you take that common sense that you know about every other thing and apply it in this physical world that we live in? If the physical world makes sense. Again, one of the ways that it's easier for me than it is for Cliff as the doctor, the physical world won't lie to me. Right, it'll hide and it'll be hard sometimes, but it won't directly lie to me. Like I'll lie to my doctor, right? And how many times do you exercise? 4 times a day. But of course, I don't take steroids, so that's why I've got this body. No, so that is that again.
Yeah.
For the grab the index out of this Putnam's geology, and again, back 20 years ago, this was the standard test, and it's a great amplification of all of this stuff with not any of the arm waving and hardly any jokes. So, any other questions? Tomorrow we're going to cover rocks in part of the time, and we're going to do a little visual preview of Thursday's hike. And try to continue to tie in these basic principles and common sense aspect and the beauty and the community and the licorice and beer.
Cookies.
Tomorrow's cookies. So if you want licorice, the licorice will probably still be here, but tomorrow will be cookies too, which, like the lava lamp, is not. They're not just cookies. They're a geologic training aid. All right, any other questions? See you tomorrow.